next keynote that we wanted to read is the keynote from the show up. We're going to read again. This is the last year of the keynote. It's compiled by the Moreva. First one was, again, thank Shlomo for putting this together. As every year, this goes to Shlomo for all the work that you do to put this in. And Samuel and Shalayim, she's so good to see Shalayim be built. She should be up on the Vima, with all the bone, and she's simple. It was very difficult for me this year to think about how to present the Shoah with everything that's been going on. As we've gone through something that is not, as I was noting in a minute, not necessarily similar, but our own korban, the biggest korban that we've experienced in our lifetimes. And we don't even know, as previous speakers have mentioned, what the end is going to be. And it's a very challenging time for us, and it's very challenging to, even this year we've felt through all the speakers and spoken, less focus naturally on what the main part of the day is supposed to be, on Korban HaBayis and Korban Shalayim, and more focused on something that we can all connect to a little bit easier. But nonetheless, I think it's important to note, many people have mentioned in the course of the last year that we call Hamasnik and Nazis. Many different circles, media, and so-called leaders. And I don't want to trivialize what happened in Simchas Torah and what's been happening for the last 10 months. And I also don't want to trivialize what happened, you know, 80 years ago in Europe. The Rav mentioned many times, Chayyadam calls Yishmael Pera Adam, the Torah speaks about Yishmael being a Pera Adam, the Chayyadam mentions, Rabbi Rechai, sorry, mentions that it's that the Adam is an adjective for the Pera. Shmeel are animals, and what happened on Simchas Torah is truly, in every sense, the work of an animal. There's no two ways about it. Every single thing we've heard about, every single thing we do is pure animalistic bestiality. It's horrific, the way that any animal in the jungle would act. As opposed to what happened 80 years ago to the Germans, the Nazis, they're nothing like Yishmael. They're not Pera Adam. They were Amalek, they're Edom, they're Rome. They're the descendants of Titus. Calculated in every single thing that they did. This wasn't one act that they decided they're going to go do this one thing, and even though those planned, everything so obvious was planned in advance, but the way that they acted was just a complete taiva and just the way that an animal would act, no regard for anything. The way the Nazis acted years ago, the plans that Hitler Maximal crafted with his people, where the acts of someone was pure, cold, and calculated, and had a system for every single thing, and were without the intervention of those rough ones would have destroyed us. Pure and simple. And to compare the two, I think it doesn't do justice to how terrible things were 8 years ago. We're smart people. As Rav said, we're Nadim, we're Rami, so above that, we can defeat animals. But to defeat a cold, calculated murderer who's thinking about every single step and is thinking ahead every single step and is psychologically trying to destroy us as well as physically trying to destroy us is much more difficult. I tried to find some new material this year that I hadn't looked at in the past, but still being something of a personal nature. When I grew up, one of the people who had a significant impact on my life as a young boy, as a young man, in my childhood, was someone who grew up in a very prominent member of my show. His name was Mr. Freddy Englard. He was a person who was a very pushy person, very diminutive person. He was very short in stature, but extremely powerful. When he davened, he was about Bakor, he was about Tzvila. When he davened, all the kids knew exactly the inflection of voices. I mean, he got in the exact same way every single time. And it literally felt like the walls were shaking. He had such passion. He had such everything. When he got in, he put every single part of his body into it. Every single cough he had into every tefillah, no matter what. It could be Techol, it could be Shabbos Musaf, it could be when he died in the Maariv on Yom Narayim, when he died in Tzilas Geshem. I still remember his Tzilas Geshem to this day, 40 years later. And so I went and I Googled, to see, find some of the history of him, and I didn't even realize that he had, I knew he'd probably done an interview for the Spielberg Institute, and I didn't even realize that my mother, who was a trained interviewer for the Shoah, was the person who had interviewed him. And so I went and listened to his interview and recorded a lot of it, transcribed a lot of it. And I want to first give a little bit of background history, and then a few of the vignettes and a few of the lessons that I took from listening to this interview. So Engler grew up, was born and grew up, was raised in Lodz. Lodz was a town in southwestern Poland. It was the second largest town at the time in Poland. It was very close to the German border. Before the war started, there was a population of about 665,000 people, about a third of which were Jewish. The Jewish community in Lodz was very diverse. There was all different types. There was Hasidish, there was regular Mitzvah, every single type was there. It was a main center of business in Poland. A lot of textiles and manufacturing was done there. A very, very large city. When Nazis take, because it was so close to Germany, the Nazis came in, and within 8 days, they had already conquered Lodz and already taken it over. And because it was so close, many of the people there were of German descent and helped the Germans, and it was very simple and easy to conquer. In 1940, in April 30th of 1940, the ghetto in Lodz was established, which is the second largest ghetto behind the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, and it was extremely isolated. No one could get in, no ghetto. It was completely cut off from the rest of the world. They banned Jews from going on trains, from owning cars, from having radios. Anyone who got near the fence, it wasn't electrified, but anyone who got near the fence was shot on the spot. There wasn't a question. So they had no connection to the rest of the world for the 4 years that the ghetto was open. There were 164,000 Jews that were put into this ghetto. This ghetto was put in the worst part of town. Many Jews there that were poor, and many Jews there that were more affluent. And all the Jews were carted into the literally the biggest slum in the town, into a small, tiny little area. Mortality was extremely high. There were epidemics, there was typhus, there was, obviously, people died of starvation. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. About 21%, 43,500 people died in the ghetto of either starvation or cold or disease. The conditions were horrific. In the end, in 1944, they decided to liberate the ghetto. First in 42, well, I guess I'm right. 1944, they decided to liberate the ghetto. Between August 7th, 1944, and August 30th, 74,000 people were sent to Auschwitz. Most of them met their end there. And when the ghetto was liberated by Russia in 1945, there were only 800 people left. So again, I want to go through some of the history of where Mr. Engblom came from. I want to go through some of the things that I personally took out of what he said. First of all, it's very interesting to note that there's a lot of things that he echoed that I think are very relevant today. One of the questions that's always asked in these interviews is, did you experience anti-Semitism before 1939, before the war started? And every single person I've heard answer the same was, it was there. It was there. There definitely people hated us, and we got things, but I never personally experienced it. I never personally experienced anything. We just lived our lives, and they didn't like us much, but it was there. It sounds very eerily similar to what goes on in the rest of the world today. He discussed the night that they were forced into the ghetto. It was 1944. 40, it was 1940. They lived far from where the ghetto was being established, on a little bit more of a comfortable street. And I want to quote, since they came in about 7 o'clock in the evening, they started shooting in the air and screaming. The dogs were barking, get out from the houses, go out from the houses. And we hear like that, everyone has to go down to the courtyard. And I stood there with my parents. I was with my parents. His sisters had already fled. They went to Warsaw with their families. They did not make it out. He also said, I had my friends. They had our parking block had 400, had 200 people in it, and we're all got out, and we're all sitting there on the streets. He's with his parents and his four friends. And the Germans are shooting in the air, and they're screaming, schnell, hurry up. The dogs are barking. One of the Germans came, and he's looked straight into the eyes of every single person there. He says, one of my friends was a very unusually handsome man. I like Rabbi Shmuel that I've described before. And everybody who noticed him looked at him and appreciated that he was a very unusually handsome person. And the Germans came and he looked me in the eyes and he looked at my parents in the eyes and he looked at my friend, this handsome man who stood next to me and looked at him in the eyes. And to that man, he said to him, you're too handsome to be a Jew. And he killed him on the spot. Right in front of everybody. This was one of his best friends, and this is what started with. They were forced into the ghetto. They didn't have any, as I said, connection to the outside world. They had no idea what was going on. In 1942, just to give you an idea of what they did, in other situations we've heard about in the camps, that we give maybe a slice of bread and a potato to everybody to survive on, which is horrible enough. What they did at Lodge was they gave each family a loaf of bread at the beginning of the week, and that was it. If you get a slice of bread every day, it's very hard, or even every meal, it's very hard to subsist on, but you make it through the day because you know tomorrow you get another slice of bread. When you have a loaf of bread in front of you, just to see the psychological games they played, how they toyed with us, your brain says, you want to eat it right now, you're starving right now. Some of us probably a little hungry right now, and in 5 hours, we're going to be very hungry. If you see a loaf of bread in front of you, you're going to want to, you know, to eat as fast as possible, but you can't. And if you do, you have nothing the rest of the week. And therefore, many people died. In 1942, they had instituted something called what they called Aktion, which is some basically deportation orders where they would clear out the ghetto of different Jews who they didn't think were working properly or were valuable enough to them. They'd clear out first the elderly, anyone over 65, anyone under the age of 10, and they forced families to give over these people to them. But and they didn't know what they were going was going to happen to them, but they assumed it to be their death and death of them. In 1 week, in September of 42, there was an act on that 20,000 people had to be handed over. Much of this had to be done by the head of the Judenrat, which his name was Mordechai Chaim Lomkowski. I'll get to him again in a minute. And they had to decide who was Miyamos, basically. And people had to hand over the children. If they didn't, they knew that they're going to be given, someone else was going to be given over. He described that week how he locked his parents in a shed in the garage, something with a lock on the outside of the door. As we just mentioned, if you can imagine, these were Germans. 20,000 people means 20,000 people. If there's only 19,000, that means you're going to have to find another 1,000. And for 8 days, they had to sit there and wait every single day who's going to be taken out, who's not. All these people were carted off to Chelmno, which is a concentration camp that preceded really the concentration camp of Auschwitz. And they found out, the Germans found out there how to work with gas. They basically took all these people out, took them to the forest, put them in vans, put an exhaust pipe in the van, and that was happening at the end. He talks about this person, Mordechai Chaim Lomkowski, who was vilified as being known as someone who helped the Nazis, as a Jew who helped the Nazis to save himself. But just to teach you the level of amazing level of these people, when he talks about him, he talks about how he's done with Chaskos. He said this guy had a gun to his head. He didn't know what his best was worth. He He could have been Gronkowski's list instead of Schindler's list. He's trying to save as many people as possible. If you read anything about this man, you'll know this man took a lot of advantage of things that were going on and sold a lot of people to their debts. But Mr. Engler would never look at another Jew like that. It was always done with us, so that maybe he had a gun to say no choice and did what he could to save Klal Yisrael. He talks about the deportation to Auschwitz in 1944. He was still with his parents. He was still in the cattle cars. And he describes that something that he says, you know, seeing is believing. When you see something, you believe it. He says, everything I saw that year, everything I saw in front of me, I couldn't believe my eyes. You get out and you're in the cattle car for days and it's fresh air finally and you look up and everything's, the smell hits you and there's yelling and the Germans are barking at you and the dogs and the rifles are going and you're being separated from your family. You don't even know what's going on, right? All of a sudden frown left, the women left, the men to the right. And, you know, within a second, your mother's gone. Taken away from you, ripped apart from you and you never see her again. And there's a selection, and then your father ripped apart, and you're on your own. He says, we didn't act like people. We couldn't, because we weren't people anymore. We were dehumanized, and you just put your foot in front of the other. There's no thinking anymore. There's nothing you can do. He talks about one famous Misa that occurred to him that was made very famous by Elie Wiesel. It's not clear if it was the same Hashem, I think it was. Elie Wiesel made this story very, very famous. Maybe not necessarily for us, but for great reasons. Because he talks about this in his book, Night, as Rosh Hashanah that he played with the Tshuva, apparently, for this, but basically abandoned Baruch Hu. But my friend was there. He says, however they can do it, they got together a minion for Meir and Rosh Hashanah night. They didn't even know it. It was even hard for them to figure out what night was Rosh Hashanah. They figured it out and got a minion. They didn't have any machzorim with them. It was the night. Obviously, the davening for the night is a little bit easier to remember than the davening during the day. And they got a minion together. That sounds like it was a large minion. And they took turns. He was one of the Baalei Tefillah. We took turns trying to remember about that, the Tefillah, and to just be or everybody said there's someone who gave a drasha. And he says, you know, I took a little bit, but I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't go on. Someone else took over for me. He says, it was a very, very emotional evening. It was an evening of tears. He said, we can make kiddush from the tears that we had that night. Imagine these are people who have lived with no humanity for already 5 years. And the only thing they're striving to do is make a minyan on Rosh Hashanah and to yell out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Interview asked, what did you believe in the war? Did you still believe in God? Again, this is someone who's lived through again. I quote, yes, I don't question God because as a human being, what I don't understand doesn't mean something doesn't exist. Who am I to understand everything in the universe? My grandfather would come, if he was here, would come to see the world. This was 30 years ago. We'd never believe there could be a fax machine, there could be a TV, there could be a radio. It developed technology. So for me, this quotes an old Yiddish poem that says, even when the sun doesn't shine, I believe the sun will shine. God, I don't understand. That I believe. I think one of the things that we're missing today is Emunah Pshuta. We focus on all the things that we're supposed to be doing, all the chumim, everything we're supposed to be doing, and we are all things ways to come closer to Hashem. But there's an Emunah Pshuta that Klal Yisrael had in Europe that I don't know that we have anymore. For someone to go through the Gehenna they've gone through and to still be able to say, I don't understand God, but I believe Him. That's really all we're supposed to be doing. He was later, time was late, so I'm gonna wrap up. He talks about the death march that he went through, how he was close to death and he was saved. I just wanted to end. One of the things that he says kept him going the entire time is that he's happened to be a very, very positive person. He's a person who always was smiling. He loved children. He loved all of us. We all felt like his grandchildren. So he was blessed with only one daughter and two grandchildren. I don't know if they were close to Torah mitzvahs. But he was always smiling, always with his tune on his lips, and always encouraging us to move forward. Somebody mentioned earlier that we shall take something from this Tisha B'Av that we can take with us, and taking big things is very hard. I think Tony's a perfect example of someone who's always very positive. The impact of some of positivity, another Jew, and a smile, put a smile on another person's face when they're down, can get you through a war, can get you through the worst Gehenna you possibly get. I'd like to mention that there's only one other person that I know that I'm aware of that I came in contact with in life, who came from Lodz. It's my uncle, of Ayan Yehuda, and then Avin Yosef HaKohen, whose first yard site is on Tuba on Sunday. There's also a person who must have been something there in the air, I don't know, but there's also a person who was known for his chesed and is known for constantly putting smiles on people's faces, through riddles, through magic tricks, through anything you do. Even when he said over of art, it was with a smile and a glee that the person just had to smile back. And I think if we try to take this one little thing of trying to be as positive as possible, I'm saying this mostly to myself because I'm not always known as the most positive, smiley person, but to try to make an effort to put a smile on somebody else's face. As everyone has mentioned in the previous speeches, we don't know what the smallest little things can do. And small little things can help bring us so that Simchas Torah became a Tisha B'Av. Tzrat Hashem Tisha B'Av will become Simchas Torah.